Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is author Stephen Mayfield. Stephen has just released his first book. It's a collection of short stories titled Howling at the Moon. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me.
Maybe we could start with a little bit of a biographical question. Who is Stephen Mayfield?
That's a tough thumbnail to give. I'm a retired neonatologist. I was a physician for about 25 years, and during that time I was writing also, and I quit to write full-time about 7 years ago, quit medicine to write full-time about 7 years ago. I live in San Francisco now after spending about 20 years in Boise, Idaho, and that's about it. I mean, for now, I've lived in different parts of the country, and at this point, I am enjoying the living close to the bay in San Francisco.
I couldn't quite hear what you said. What sort of tologist?
I was a neonatologist. I took care of premature babies in intensive care.
Oh, okay. Oh, what a job!
Yeah.
You've just published Howling at the Moon. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
The book is a collection of short stories, and 9 short stories. 4 of them were previously published in literary journals. I spent part of 2009 rewriting them. I never really liked the way they finished. I never finish anything, my wife tells me. I always have to keep rewriting things. 5 are new for the book. And it was really just something that I had sitting on a shelf wanting to get out for a long time. And I was working on a novel, and I took a break from that for about 6 months and put that together and was able to get it published.
How long have you been writing? You know, obviously this is something that you've been doing off and on for a considerable time.
Yeah, I've been writing really since I was about 9 years old. I started out writing terrible poetry when I was 9, long, epic, rhyming poems about folk heroes of the time, and it was just awful stuff. I sort of graduated like a lot of young people do to writing ghost stories for my friends in junior high and high school. And by the time I got to college, I really felt like that's what I wanted to do with my life. Spent a couple years in California trying to make a go of it in television, and then found out I was going to be a father. And that's when I decided that probably medicine had a brighter future for me. So went to medical school, and I gave up writing fiction in 1974 for almost 20 years. But during that time, I was writing for the scientific literature, so I wrote a lot of articles in medical journals and book chapters and that sort of thing. And I was sitting in my office at the University of Texas, Southwestern, in the late 80s, around 89, and suddenly this idea for the final scene of the book came to me. It was the first time I'd had any fiction sort of come into my head for probably 15 years. And I sat down and wrote what ended up being the last chapter of a novel that is still sitting on my shelf. It's a great idea that hasn't quite been able to come to fruition yet. So I started writing short stories again, just as a start, and started getting published around 94 again. And by 2003, I decided I would leave medicine and just go to writing full time.
I'm interested as talking about the short story route. I know that I've talked to many authors, and they've used short stories as a way of honing their skills. Oftentimes, they don't publish their short stories until, you know, way later in their careers. Is that the reason you took the short story route, was to hone your writing skills before plunging into a full-length novel?
I think your other writer friends must have, you know, considerably more organized thought where this stuff is concerned, because I just sort of write what comes to me. And I think that I was honed on short stories as a kid. I mean, when I was 10, I was reading O. Henry and reading short fiction by Mark Twain, and they were tremendous influences on me. And I think that, you know, Guy de Maupassant and some of the masters of short story, I was very much influenced by that. And I think that when I first started to write fiction, that's what I wrote, because that's what I had been drawn to. And I like the short story. I mean, I like the format. It's thematic. And if you're a little bit lazy, it's not a bad route to go, because you can just sort of create a narrative break and stop in the middle of something, and you don't have to bother with all of these explanations as to how a character got from one place to another. You can just stop and say, well, I'll have a narrative break, and then I'm going to have them in a completely different place and at a slightly different time. Of course, that always comes back to bite you, because you have to do more work to sort of make that come out okay in the end. But that's sort of where I'm at with it. I like the short story format, and I continue to think of short story ideas all the time, although I'm mostly working on a book right now.
I think short stories are really are an art form. When they're done correctly, every word counts, shall we say. You know, you can cram an awful lot of story into 5 or 10 pages, you know, if you're economic with the way that you write. And I have to give you incredibly high marks. Your stories are so well crafted. So pat yourself on the back.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. This interview may not be a representative of that. I tend to ramble when I'm talking to people, but when I write, a lot of the influence in the way I write now has come from all those years of writing scientific papers. That's a field where truly every word counts, and there's no extra space in a medical journal for unnecessary language. I really kind of learned how to write with discipline when I was writing scientific papers. Prior to that, I was mostly devoted to the idea of story and not so much to the idea of composition as to how it was formed. And that's a little bit like a painter who's interested in the idea of the picture, but not really interested in the brushstrokes. I think that scientific writing really, really taught me to be disciplined and taught me that every word does count.
That's interesting. I have a friend who is a publisher, and his specialty is factual books, primarily living history. And he tells a wonderful story about an author, Terry Turchi. Terry was the lead FBI investigator on the Unabomber case, Ted Kaczynski, and wrote this fabulous sort of biography, almost, called Hunting the American Terrorist. And the story goes that the first version of the manuscript was a 400-page long FBI report.
Yeah.
Absolutely useless for the purpose of publishing a book. So they had to take Terry to one side and teach him how to write again.
That sort of happened to me. I actually had won a prize for fiction, the Mari Sandoz Prize for Fiction in 1971 when I was very young. And I, as I say, I had tried to work exclusively as a writer for a couple of years and went to medical school. Well, when I finished medical school, I was doing my internship in pediatrics at the University of Iowa. And I started to become interested in biomedical research and found a professor there who was mentoring me. And we did a project together, and by a year or two later, I was writing the paper. Well, I was a little smug about my ability to write because I thought, well, you know, these scientific papers are boring and dry, and I'm going to add a little pizzazz to it. And I wrote the first draft of this paper, which was overly long, on the project we'd done together. And my mentor there used a red pen to edit. And he took my paper, he had it for a couple of days, and when it came back to me, it looked like he'd opened a vein onto it. It was just red everywhere. And I was angry about it. I just thought, nobody can tell me how to write. And then I began to look at it, and I realized that for what he was, for what we were the audience we were trying to reach and the journals that we were trying to get this published in, that what I had given them was essentially useless. And that was really the beginning for me of an education that I ended up editing for some medical journals and ended up, when I first left medicine, I started working as a freelance editor. And it all started with this guy sort of bleeding onto a horribly written scientific paper that ultimately we did get published.
Actually, on the subject of editing, that's another one of my hot buttons. So many people feel that they can do no wrong. Their writing is perfect, and rarely is that the case. In fact, there was one author that I reviewed, and the storyline was wonderful. I mean, he had a great idea, but the execution was absolutely horrible. So I asked him about it in a kind of roundabout way. Had he used a professional editor? And his response literally left me speechless. He said, "Yes, I did. I had this top flight, incredibly, horrendously expensive editor who hacked my work to pieces. I was so annoyed. I fired them, and then it took me 6 months to get it back the way I wanted it."
Yeah. Well, I came to realize a long, long time ago that no matter how right I think I am, there's always a chance that I'm wrong about anything. That's not just writing. And I think I said earlier, I am constantly rewriting things. I mean, even with this latest book that came out, I look at it, I'll look at a story, and I'll realize, well, gosh, I should have changed that, or I missed this. I have, a word that I've used too often in a given span of narrative. And my wife says that I just never stop. And so in part, one of the reasons I wanted to get this book out is I was sick of rewriting. I just thought, I'm going to rewrite this thing until I'm, got one foot in the grave if I don't stop and see if I can get it published.
Right. There's a finality about publishing. You know, mm-hmm. Okay, it's done. I can put my editor's hat away. But I do know some authors though that still tinker on. You know, they'll find something they don't like, change, and in this world of on-demand publishing, it's relatively easy to make changes and release a new version of the book. What sort of reader feedback are you getting?
So far, it's been good. I've been gratified. I think the short story genre is not one that is really all that popular these days. I'm reminded of, reading of Kurt Vonnegut and John Cheever in the heyday of short stories and magazines. And Vonnegut had published a book some years ago before his death, called The Bogombo Snuff Box, which was the name of a story, and it was a collection of short stories. And he sort of bemoaned the fact that television had changed the shorts, what people do with the short story in America, that there was a time when you'd get the Saturday Evening Post and you'd read the short story and then you'd leave it for the next family member who would then read it. And you'd pass it around almost as if people pass around snippets on YouTube or online or pass DVDs back and forth with films on them. And I think that was a different era. And I think short stories are something you would think people would be interested in reading in today's world, where they want to get something that's quick. But they are a tough sell. The readers, so far, readers and reviewers have been kind to me, you among them, thank you. And so I'm gratified by that, and I think that's really something that's more important to me, I think, than commercial success. I don't anticipate that a collection like this is going to be commercially real successful, but one hopes that the people who do read it will enjoy it. When I originally wrote it, I honestly had a relatively small audience. I hadn't published any fiction since 2005, and that was by choice. I had been I'd ghostwritten a couple of books for other people during that time, between 05 and 08, and then I started working on a novel, and I had sort of decided that I really was only interested in what my wife and my writing friends thought of my work, and I wasn't ever going to submit anything ever again. And of course, that fell by the wayside.
On the subject of commercial success, where can people buy copies of Howling at the Moon?
It's available online. It's available through the usual venues, Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, and through the publisher's website, MountParnassusPress.com. And so people can just Google it, and I encourage them to Google Howling at the Moon and Stephen Mayfield, because there's some other Howling at the Moon books out. I didn't realize this, and should have. I should have anticipated that there would be other books with this title, and it turns out that they're mostly vampire and werewolf books. So if you just pull up Howling at the Moon, then you may get thrown into a Twilight type of publication. I'm sorry?
No, carry on.
Oh, I was just going to say, the book is distributed by the big book distributors, and so it can be picked up at by ordering from any bookstore. Any bookstore can order it if they don't have it in stock. And I understand that a bunch of libraries have been ordering books. That's what I'm told by the publisher. So it may be at your local library.
That's some good news.
Yeah, I thought so.
Do you yourself have a web page supporting the book?
The page is really through Mount Parnassus Press, www.mountparnassuspress.com. And if people go to that site, and click on the cover, they can read an excerpt from the book. And there's also a way to contact me personally by email if people have questions or comments. So it's www.mountparnassuspress.com.
Okay, I'll make sure I include that in my text article about this interview.
Okay.
Do you have a personal favorite story in Howling in the Moon?
Well, I do, and it's interesting because I've literally received no feedback on that particular story. I think one reviewer mentioned it. My favorite story is Which Way's Ireland, which is the last story in the book, and I don't think I'm giving away too much as I reveal that it's a story about it takes place in 1927, and it's a story about a fellow who takes off in an airplane to fly solo across the Atlantic at the exact same time that Charles Lindbergh is taking off. But their subsequent courses take them in very different directions, and as do their lives. And the story is really about three different people. It's about Lindbergh, it's about this fictitious flyer, and it's really about the man who's telling the story. He tells it as a very old man recalling it as a boy in 1927 when he was 10 years old and saw this airplane that Lester Quicksilver, the fictitious flyer, was in.
I've got to admit that I did like that story. In fact, I liked them all. I thought they were all delightful. In fact, an amusing little anecdote for you. I like to sit outside and read natural light and my failing eyesight, I guess. And so I grabbed my cup of coffee. I grabbed Howling at the Moon and off onto the porch I went. And I don't know why, but I looked at the table of contents, and there was one title that caught my eye: Hall Sex or Hallway Sex.
Hallway Sex.
Hallway
yeah.
Sex. I thought to myself, oh, that reminds me of a joke from the 70s about something like the three stages of marriage. I've got to check this story out. And sure enough, you know, the opening paragraph was that self-same joke.
Yes, yeah. That was a story that I actually wrote for a friend whose marriage was in trouble, and she was unable to communicate to her husband what the issues were, and she had confided in me, and she asked me to write something, and that story is what came from that. It's interesting where all these stories come from. They sort of pop up in from odd places. Which Way's Ireland came from watching the old movie, The Spirit of St. Louis. I was actually writing a story that ultimately became the first chapter of a book I'm working on, and The Spirit of St. Louis was on, with Jimmy Stewart. It's an old movie from about 1957 or 1958.
Right.
And I looked up and I saw this movie, and I was watching the end when Lindbergh lands in Paris, and he's carried off by the crowd, and he's sort of panicky because the character in the movie is panicky because he believes that his plane's going to be damaged by this mob and he doesn't want to be pulled away. And I suddenly started thinking about the irony that at the moment of triumph, he still had such great uncertainty. And I started thinking, well, what would happen if somebody had taken off and simply gotten lost and not made it? and had a sort of a parallel life to Lindbergh. So that's where that story came from. It ultimately ended up being about something entirely different, but it all began just because I was sitting watching an old movie.
So I guess we can say there's a story behind every story.
Yeah, and sometimes more than one.
Right.
The next one, which is the story about a school teacher in New Orleans, came from just a single little snippet that I was told by a woman who taught school in the 1960s in New Orleans. And she, we were in New Orleans. Her husband and I were at a medical conference, and the three of us were walking around the French Quarter. And she stopped all of a sudden in front of the school, and she said, "I taught at this school." And she began to tell me these stories about her teaching experience. And the next one began there. I took notes, and probably close to 10 years later, I pulled those notes out and began to write the story that became the next one.
That's great. In my review, I theorized that your next project was going to be a full-length novel, and in fact, you have mentioned this novel a couple of times in the interview. Can you share any information with us about it?
Sure, I'd like to. The book is tentatively entitled Delphic Oracle, but it's not about Greece. It's actually about a small town in Nebraska with the name of Delphic Oracle, Nebraska. It's a fictitious town. And it's populated by a lot of oddball characters, and each chapter has as its protagonist one of these characters, yet they all appear in all the chapters, and one sort of feeds into the next. And it's really a story about nearly a century in America and the different lives that made up our nation and in what happened to them, the changes that occurred. It's about their successes and failures, and it's about their hopes and about their disappointments. But in the end, it's really about the idea that if you wait long enough, people will show you their good side. And that's actually a quote that I stole. I can't take credit for that. Randy Pausch, who was a Carnegie Mellon professor who passed away a couple of years ago, had written a book that became very well known during the last couple of years of his life, and it was about dying with dignity. And his quote was, "Wait and people will show you their good side." I can't say that he motivated me to write the book, but I can say that when I got the first draft done, I realized that what I was trying to do with it is to find a way to say some things without making people feel absolutely wretched, which I think that was Vonnegut's great talent. And I think that that was another thing I learned in reading the Bogombo Snuffbox and reading all these stories that he had written between approximately 1948 and 1962. And I realized, you know, it is possible to make a point, to be honest, to say something that is important about our lives without making people feel so depressed that they just can't go on. And besides that, I do believe that people are inherently decent, and I wanted to show that as well.
I'm curious. The publisher that you're using is not one that I think I've come across. Is that a traditional house, or is it?
It's just a new small press that I came in contact with, and just opened in the last year.
Oh, okay. What are you doing in the in the way of the dreaded M word, marketing?
Well, at this point, I just actually made this transition to San Francisco over the last few months, and so the marketing part of the book has sort of fallen behind. I'm trying to set up some readings and signings, and the usual online stuff. I've had to wrestle with the whole social media Facebook experience, which is a little daunting. I'm fairly techie, but social media requires a lot more time than I think I'm willing to give.
Well, yeah, I've got to admit, I read all these articles about the joys of Facebook and Twitter and Lord knows what else, and I'm not sure I can really understand how they help.
But, well, it's today's town square, I think, for young people, but it's a town square, I think, where people have a fairly limited attention span. And I think that's one of the issues really with reading. You know, I fear for the future of literature, because so much has to come to people in short bursts. And I think that the idea of sitting down and taking the time to work your way through A Soldier in the Great War, for example, is something that I fear people are not going to be willing to do as much in the future. So we'll see. I'm not a Twitter guy. I refuse to do that. I just think anything that, you know, can't be said, or that anything worth saying, requires more than 140 characters. So I'm not going to do that. But the Facebook thing, you just about have to do. The viral marketing is, my marketing friends have convinced me, is something that you have to take on. So I've set up a Facebook page for Howling at the Moon and links to various things, including Blogger News Network, are on that page. So I encourage people to go there.
Well, I will have to. I'll have to check out your Facebook. Stephen, I'm being howled at by my automated producer. Our time is at an end. I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us this morning, and I'm sure I speak for everyone here at Blogger News in wishing you every success with Howling at the Moon.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me on.
My pleasure. So till next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a great Labor Day. Have a fun day and have a safe day. Goodbye.